You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Hello, Michael.
Andre, how are you?
It's been a difficult day, hasn't it?
Andre, I hear you tried to... Hey, this is kind of a neat computer you've got going on here.
Oh, shut up, Michael.
No, I'm just looking at it. I've never seen the colors in it before.
Yeah, I needed to make some changes to my computer because I'm doing a lot of video editing with my civilian job. And things didn't go quite as planned and some stuff failed. And it should have been a 30-minute fix and it ended up being a two-hour fix.
That's because you had an appointment. You never do a fix on an appointment day.
But I always have appointments. Anyways, enough about me. We're actually joined by someone that you had a chance to meet in Toronto a few weeks ago.
I did, and I was so impressed with... I'm popping a lot of peas here. I'm not happy about that.
I know. You need to get a mic sock like I have.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look into that. I was so impressed with these wines and with the winemaker that I wanted to get her on the podcast.
All right. And who is it, Michael?
Oh, all right. Well, I thought you had another question of sorts. I believe, and I could be wrong, and I hope she'll tell me if I am, but I think she is the first head winemaker of Mission Hill who is of the female persuasion, and it is Corey Krebel. I didn't hear the last name when we were there. I don't think you gave it, Corey.
I probably didn't. It's Krebel.
Well, I wasn't.
You weren't even close. Yeah,
oh,
you weren't even close.
God. Terrible. I'm not allowed to do names anymore.
I mean, it's no worse than your French.
No, I mean, Corey was all we called her that day, right? No, we never even called her anything but else. And I think she just said, I'm Corey the winemaker. So we all just went, all right, let's Corey the winemaker.
Corey, thank you for offering yourself up as a tribute to having the two of us in the room together.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got a trio of wines to taste. I'm actually really excited to get into this because, you know, and the listeners know, but Corey, I don't know if you know, but I have an alter ego called Captain Chardonnay because I just really love Chardonnay. And I was actually really heartbroken that I couldn't make it to the tasting that you were doing because in the email that was sent out, there was a tease of, and I haven't even seen the bottle because Michael's got them like hidden away from me, but I could see that there was a bottle of Chardonnay with a beautiful label called Perpetua. And just in general, I think I've had a hard time finding an Okanagan Chardonnay or a BC Chardonnay in general that gives me the fizz. You know, it's something that James May from the Grand Tour from Top Gear has said, like when he drives and test drives a car that really just makes him excited. And I've had a lot of BC Chardonnay that I really like. So I'm hoping that this is going to change my mind a bit. Can you, you know, let's dive right in and let's talk about Mission Hill and Chardonnay, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, we can. So the Perpetua is from our flagship series, the Legacy series, which is the top of the wines that we make. And Perpetua is always near and dear to my heart. It's one of the wines that I first started working on in 2015 when I originally joined Mission Hill. It, to me, is being made in more of a Chablis-like style. What I'm looking for is I'm looking for a freshness of fruit. I want to see that citrus and then just underlying oak with loads of texture. So the one you're tasting today has come from the 2020 vintage, which to me is a vintage that comes once in a lifetime. The vintage was incredible. It was beautiful right from flowering and set all the way through the summer. There were no real heat spikes and then we had just a beautiful fall. So it was a long, very even growing season. And I really think you see that in all of the fruit that heads through the 2020 vintage and also in our Chardonnay. So this one comes from two different vineyard sites that we have. One that's right down in Assuyus, very sandy soils, very hot. It's actually called Border Vista. It's right up against the border. And it tends to give more of the citrus drive that you'll see in this particular wine. And then the second vineyard is in Naramata, which is, you know, up the valley a touch, but very different soil profile, a little bit heavier. And that's where you tend to get more of, you know, that stone fruit that you get in this and that bit of green apple. So it was both fermented and aged in a combination of French oak barriques, French oak puncheons, and concrete, just to really build texture and weight through the wine without it looking overly oaky.
Well, Captain Chardonnay, what do you think?
I have so many questions about this, because you talked about the good growing season, but did you get that crazy, intense, hot, dry summer? Like, was it hotter and drier than normal in the Okanagan, like it was in Ontario?
It was a drier summer, but it wasn't intensely hot. We didn't have any of, say, the heat spikes that we had in, say, 2021. It was much more even.
Because the questions I have is, so this is from a southern vineyard, a border vineyard that borders the United States, which is hotter and drier than virtually anywhere in the Okanagan, if memory serves me correct. And your alcohols are 12.5% on this. Like, this certainly doesn't taste or reflect a hot vintage Chardonnay. And honestly, often I describe most of the BC wines, at least the BC wines that we get in Ontario, as kind of a mix of New World and Old World sensibilities. But in this bottle here, this is pure Old World. And I say that with the highest compliment ever, because the Chardonnays I love to drink are made in that style. I think we're seeing a pullback in oak, you know, globally in people who are making Chardonnay, with a few exceptions. The market still has room for its butter bombs. This is really, really good.
You know, the problem I have with this wine is that it's in a Bordeaux glass.
Yeah, I mean, we'll probably enjoy this after the podcast in a Burgundy glass, but we wanted to keep things moving along simply, and we have two other Bordeaux wines. So when you're dealing with a hot growing season and you're dealing with a site as hot as the South Osoyoos, how hard is it to manage the vineyard so that you're not ending up with fruit that has crazy high sugar and still having the acid to boot? Because, like, you know, when you're dealing with ripeness of grapes, like, it's not just the sugar ripeness you're looking for, but it's the phenolics. Like, do you have a challenge with getting the fruit phenolically ripe and just holding on to, like, those three things: phenolics, acids, and sugars?
So I think what comes through in our Chardonnay is the experience of our viticulture teams and how closely we've worked together over the last number of years. So yes, Osoyoos is a very hot site for us, and maybe not what you would think traditionally for a Chardonnay in this type of style. But one of the things that we've worked on is actually our canopy management to ensure there's a touch more shading that's within that canopy, so that we achieve riper fruit flavors and the citrus character that we're looking for without it going across into that lemon curd, without it having the phenolics from too much sun contact that you can end up getting. So it really, to me, is about being very sensitive to what the season is doing right from the very beginning of the year. So right from, you know, when we're starting to set those canopies up, when we're doing any leaf removal, just ensuring that we're being sensitive as to how much sun contact we're actually getting. And then also potentially pivoting a little bit later in the year if necessary, if it's looking cooler or there's less sunlight incidents.
You know, now I wish that we had a bottle. I think it's the Reserve that is the tier that occasionally makes it to the Ontario market, because I know that one is very much made in that New World, Old World style. Like, you feel like you're drinking a Californian Chardonnay when you open that bottle, but it still has that really great acid that you expect from a cooler climate growing region. This is completely different from that. So I guess that's enough of me going on about Chardonnay. This is really good. And the thing is, it's really young. Like, this is a Vin de Garde. This isn't a Vin de Soif. Like, this isn't one that, I mean, we can take it and drink it now. Sorry, Michael.
I love when you throw out the French just to do it.
It's a cellarable wine. This is a wine that's made to sit in a cellar. Like, I think it's not even going to hit.
Although I do believe it is quite quaffable as well.
It is. But, like, right now, it's a little bit more simple. The oak is buried underneath all the fruit. And with a little bit of time, everything's going to integrate. And, you know, I think the oak influence on this wine is like a Led Zeppelin guitar solo. It's going to come in like 4 minutes into the song, much like this question I'm asking.
Was there a question there?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. Corey, why don't you, while Andre enjoys his Chardonnay there, give us a little bit of history about yourself, how you come to winemaking. I had to let Andre, of course, get into the Chardonnay because otherwise he was going to chomp at the bit until we got to it. Now he can sit back, relax, enjoy his wine, and we can listen to you talk a little bit about how you come to Mission Hill, your background, and how's the experience been working at Mission Hill?
Definitely. So a little bit of my background. I was born and raised in the Okanagan Valley, which for those of you that know the Okanagan Valley, there aren't very many of us who are actually born and raised here. But from an early age, I was raised on orchards and absolutely loved, you know, the freshness of the fruit that we have here, and fell into winemaking a little bit when I was actually in high school, when a winery down the street was looking for somebody to work on the bottling line, and I truly didn't actually leave. So
sorry. I don't want to interrupt, but you said in high school? So like you were 15, 16?
Didn't have my driver's license yet. I had to be dropped off for work.
That's amazing. And you couldn't drink what you were making. I mean, you weren't supposed to be drinking what you were making.
Nope. And, you know, at that time, I was basically just on the bottling line. I would get thrown out to the gardens every once in a while. The bottling line wasn't running. I would work on, you know, hand labeling some projects if necessary. So really kind of got in from the absolute ground up. But I was fortunate at the time in that I worked with a great winemaker and a great assistant winemaker who helped coach me as to what the right direction was in schooling. So I ended up going off to UBC and doing their agriculture and food science program there, and then off to New Zealand to be more specific in winemaking and viticulture. And then really never looked back. I worked a little bit in New Zealand when I was over there, but knew that the Okanagan was where I wanted to be. I just loved the purity of the fruit here. I loved the potential of the Okanagan, especially in the early days, and decided that this was the place to be.
So now that that Andre has said his piece on the Chardonnay, I guess I can have, can I have an opinion too?
Maybe.
So I am not a Chardonnay lover in any way. I do like this Chardonnay. That's one of the reasons why I thought we should have you on the podcast, because we did pour this wine at the event, and I thought it would hit and give Andre the fizz.
Yeah, does. It does. It definitely does. Continue.
So I've already tasted it. This is my second time. I think I'm liking it better the second time than I did the first time. And I always think that is because when I like a wine at a wine tasting, it's usually out of a subpar wine glass, and then I get it home and then I put it in a proper wine glass because I am a bit of a wine glass snob. The moment you get it into that you get it into a proper wine glass, it really shines. And this wine is now even better. So I'm happy to report I like it better than I did at the event.
I'm trying to find a way to make the connection. You went to New Zealand to learn and ended up back in BC. Where were you working in New Zealand, and how has that influenced your winemaking in BC? Because you're dealing with are the climates similar or the climates different? Like, I know there's different grapes planted in New Zealand, but like it's a very interesting climate.
So I was in the South Island, and so the area around Cromwell and in the Central Otago area is actually quite similar to what the Okanagan is. You think of the big lake and, you know, the mountains around there, the cooler evenings. There are similarities, which is why, you know, at the time when I went to school, and this is going to date me, there were no oenology or winemaking programs in Canada. So the option was to, you know, head to Australia, to head to New Zealand, or to head to you know, the States down in California at UC Davis. And realistically, I felt that my best opportunity was to head somewhere that had a climate much more similar to our own, hence New Zealand.
And you grew up around the BC wine industry. How do you keep yourself from developing, I guess, a regional cellar palate? Like how do you make sure that your winemaking is like at the top of its game? Because this is very, going back to the Chardonnay, very atypical of what the Chardonnays in the region are, and that's not me talking about how good the wine is again, though. But like, this is very much like influenced not by the other Chardonnays in the region. Like, you could have easily made, like, what, you know, what Burrowing Owl does with their Chardonnay, or what Tantalus is doing with their Chardonnay, or what, you know, I think Anne Sperling and Sperling is making it up there. So I just had to get some name drops out there to show that I know a few wineries out there.
So that, to me, is incredibly important, because it is very easy to get known, or what is known as cellar palate. And that's really when you get used to tasting your own wines and you only make, you know, wines that are similar, or only like wines that are similar to what you make. So, A, I have traveled a lot in my career, especially through France and Italy, where I take a lot of inspiration from that old world style. And then I drink a lot of wine that is not Okanagan based. And then thirdly, I do a lot of competitive set tasting. So looking at our wines, not only against what is produced in the valley, but what's produced globally. Our owner absolutely wants to make sure that our wines are among the best in the world. And so that means also looking to the outside as to what they're doing.
What's a competitive set tasting?
So a competitive set is essentially going out and purchasing different wines from other areas of the world. So say Chardonnay. So, you know, heading through Burgundy, heading and looking at a bunch out of Sonoma and purchasing these wines and tasting our wine blind against other wines of the world.
I had no idea how we sit. I had no idea it had a real name. I just thought it was go out and buy other wines and we'll taste them side by side.
I just wanted the explanation, because, like, I think it is something that's important to do, even if you're a large winery like Mission Hill. But the little tiny wine company that I run, when we made our Pinot Noir, we weren't sure how good ours were. We were worried that we had a little bit too much hubris. So we went and bought 10 bottles ranging in price from, you know, $30 to $80, local, a couple international, same vintage, different vintage, just to make sure that we weren't as full of crap as we thought they were. So, like, to hear you explain that you at Mission Hill are continuing to do that to make sure you're looking outward is, I think that's fantastic. I think that's fantastic for consumers to hear. I think it's fantastic for anyone else in the wine industry to hear, because I have heard stories of wineries in Ontario where winemakers will not taste anything but what they're doing. And, you know, it can be a problem in terms of quality control.
I think so too. And we really need our winemakers to go out and taste a whole bunch of stuff. I think it's something that's a little more rare than it used to be.
I think so too.
But, Corey, I've been to New Zealand, and the thing that shocked me about being in New Zealand was, as Andre, you know, was kind of shocked and wondering how their climate was. I was shocked that they did olive oil there. So that tells you what kind of climate that they have. And it was really good olive oil, but it was one of those shockers that you think there's no way we grow it. We can't do olive oil in Canada.
Are there olive trees in the Okanagan yet?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Not that I've seen, but I won't say that there aren't somewhere.
That's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that. So, Corey, we're going to go with probably what is my favorite wine at the moment. And this was my choice for the podcast. It's the Quatrain. Now, this, if I'm not mistaken, used to be a Merlot-dominated blend, for those who know the Mission Hill story. But somewhere along the line, this changed. Would you like to tell us about the Quatrain while I pour some for Andre?
Absolutely. So Quatrain is four lines of a verse. So our take on Quatrain is the principal varieties of a Bordeaux, so Merlot, Cab Franc, and Cab Sauv. But then the fourth, or the high tone, is that Syrah. So up until 2016, we had Merlot as the dominant variety that sat in Quatrain. But in 16, we looked at, you know, our legacy portfolio, and we have the compendium, which is more Cabernet Sauvignon driven. We have Oculus, which is Merlot driven, and we really wanted to give Quatrain the identity that it deserved. So in 16, Syrah became the dominant component. So in the 2018 that you're trying right now, that's 47% Syrah. So almost half of the blend in this particular year is Syrah, followed by Cab Sauv, Merlot, and Cab Franc. So there's no recipe with these legacy blends. It all comes down to the bench and blending on trial form to see what the best balance is as to percentage of varieties in any particular year. So 2018 was an interesting one to me. It's one that in my mind, I always think it was a hot season, but it wasn't. It was actually, you know, a fairly cool vintage all the way through. But I think that's why it leaves you with, you know, some bright acidity on the finish as well. When we blend Quatrain, I'm really looking to see that Syrah. So I want the generosity in the mouth. I want that blue fruit and that touch of spice there. And then the Merlot is going to give that fleshy component in the middle and Cab Sauv that tight line through the back.
Do you think Syrah is up and coming in the South Okanagan?
I think that Syrah has great potential in the Okanagan. I see more people planting Syrah. I think what's critical for Syrah is that it's planted in the right place. It doesn't have a lot of tolerance to cooler vintages, I would say. So you absolutely have to make sure it's in the right location.
I think what you just said should be a mantra for Syrah growers everywhere. The number of times I think, Michael, you and I have said that about Syrah in Ontario.
Well, that it's too green to do something. This was absolutely my favorite wine that was poured at the event. I love BC Syrah. So it's my turn to wax a little poetic, as Andre did with Chardonnay. I get to wax a little bit about Syrah. I have tried, because I do judging at the All-Canadian Wine Championships, and I get to try the Syrah category every so often. And I really realize how great British Columbia Syrah is. And then I taste things like Pinot Noir, which, you know, I've read many articles that say, oh, the next big up-and-coming grape in British Columbia is Pinot Noir.
It is not.
And I think, what a load of hooey that is. It's Syrah, because those are the wines that I really gravitate towards, and I'm thrilled.
Okay, actually, you know, sorry to jump on this just really quickly.
I'm thrilled that Quatrain has become a Syrah-dominated wine. I'll stop there and let Andre...
I'll let you jump back
not
in.
Not that you not dominated the Chardonnay conversation, please.
I actually want to throw it to Corey. I want to throw it to Corey. I actually don't want to say anything, because we get limited access to BC wines across the board in Ontario. Generally, the larger producers... not a handful of artisanal producers, and we just threw some shade at Pinot Noir. Do you have any strong opinions about whether there's a change in face happening or what really should be defining? And I know it's hard when you're dealing with an entire region. I actually have a question here.
I know
when you're dealing with an entire region that spans from, you know, Kelowna all the way down to the U.S. border there. Like, what should be the international and the... And it sucks that we have to say international because we're in Ontario, but the international identity of BC. Is it Pinot Noir, or is it Syrah, or is it something else?
I think it comes down to location. So I don't think that you can take, you know, what is grown around the Kelowna area and what's grown around the Sioux area and say that there's only one variety for both areas. So if I was to look around the Kelowna area, I do think Pinot Noir. The Pinot Noirs in this area can be very concentrated, beautiful tannin structure sitting there, and quite dense. But if you go down towards the border in Asuyas and Oliver, it's way too warm for Pinot Noir down there. So as to flagship grapes, yes, Syrah does well. I love Cabernet Franc in the southern areas. I just think it has such a fine tannin structure to it. It can be elegant. It has crushed herb characters. I truly think Cab Franc is a great variety for the Okanagan. Merlot is always incredibly consistent. It doesn't matter what the vintage brings, it's going to ripen well. So those two varieties, I think, for the southern Okanagan are ones that are on the top of mind.
Interesting, because... here in Ontario, we have like our core—is it a core five or a core six these days?
Core five.
So it's Riesling, Chardonnay,
Gamay,
Cabernet
Franc,
Pinot Noir,
Cabernet Franc,
and then they've added another white to the blend too.
No.
I think they're saying Pinot Gris or something.
No, it's the Mighty Handful, and Pinot Gris is the most boring grape on the planet from Ontario. I stand by
it's
that.
It's the most boring grape in the wine in the world of wine. Let's go with that.
Do you want to say some more about Quatrain, or can I ask some nerdy marketing questions about it?
I just want to this is the kind of wine that I would just sit on and sip. But I was going to ask Corey if when we tasted it at the tasting in Toronto, if you had decanted it in any way, shape, or form?
Yes, we did dump it beforehand. We're just releasing the 2018 right now, and the wine is still very tight. So we actually double decanted all of those wines.
See, because I am a big fan of wine coming out of bottle. Because I think when you decant, you kind of miss all that middle part. It's, to me, it's like watching the first 5 minutes of a mystery show or reading the first chapter of a book and then reading the last chapter to find out how they did it. You miss all that great intrigue in the middle.
That was way more profound than you usually are, so congratulations.
Well, it's an old trope of mine.
Okay.
But I really love the elegance of this wine straight out of bottle, because we did not decant it. We just uncorked it probably half an hour ago. It really shows that this wine has an elegance and an ageability. I remember the smooth and suppleness of the wine in Toronto because of that decanting. Here you get those nice fine tannins. You get that nice spice. Like, I really think this wine, you know, is ageable, but for those who have the patience to live with it over the course of an evening, like open it up at 6 o'clock and stay up till midnight, see where it goes in 6 hours, I think you'd also be very happy with it.
You know, wines like this, I think it, like, Corey, just hats off to you to the testament of good winemaking, because most people don't age wines. They buy the wines, they take them home, and they drink them. And those short tannins that you were just describing, this right out of the bottle is a very good, very easy drinking wine, and definitely, I don't even know the price, but like, I know I would spend quite a bit of money on this. Do we want to go on the price?
I don't know. Corey's a winemaker. They usually don't know the price of their wines, unless Corey does.
I try to ignore them. Out in Western Canada, it's $85.
There we go. This is an $85 wine, and it's ready to drink now, although it is a little rough around the edges. I think the double decanting that you said, I wish I'd been at the event to see what that would be like. But I agree with Michael. As a critic, I like being able to drink the wine right out of the bottle to kind of see where it's going to go. Now, here's the thing. Because the tannins are short, and we recently just did an interview with Ridge Vineyards in California, and the whole concept of longevity is now being thrown for a loop, because it seems like you winemakers have done this, especially good experienced winemakers have got this alchemy taking place where you've got these wines that are ready to drink younger but still have the longevity that they did. I don't like my wines to taste like an old baseball glove. I think Michael's got more tolerance for the baseball glovedness of old wines. If I were buying this $85 bottle of Quatrain and I like to drink at the moment when the tannin starts to soften, but the fruit is still kick-ass and bright, what would you say is the beginning of my drinking window?
So Quatrain, I do find, tends to be approachable a little bit earlier, as you've alluded to. You could easily be drinking this for the next 5 to 10 years without seeing any massive degradation to the fruit that's sitting there.
Perfect.
As far as the baseball glove, Andre, my father was a first baseman. Okay. And he had an old baseball glove from the 50s.
Okay.
Or in the 40s, 50s. So it was one of those really, and by the time I saw it, it was an old.
Okay, so Corey, if you're someone like Michael who wants the wines to get those secondary and tertiary notes, what is the drinking window for something like Quatrain where it's going to smell like that and taste like that baseball glove from the 50s that Michael clearly has a romantic feeling about?
This one's always such a hard question to answer as well, because it depends so much on your storage conditions. Because if you have optimal storage conditions, they're going to age much better.
All right,
I'm just going to hazard a guess. At 10 to 15 years, you're probably going to start finding some of the little bit of leatheriness coming through.
Well, I was going to say, let me describe my cellar conditions. I've got a basement in Hamilton that is relatively stable in temperature, summer and winter, sits around 15 to 18 degrees Celsius. I have issues with humidity in the winter. Like, the humidity drops from about December till March to about 20%, but in the summer it sits around 80%, so corks are a problem. But let's just say I have a good cellar conditions, but not optimal and primo. And I think most people would be more like me than like Michael with your optimal cellar.
I think the most important thing is consistency of temperature.
Perfect.
You don't want massive swings in temperature at all. You don't want the, you know, your cellar to be too warm. And that 15 to 16 degrees Celsius is not an issue. It's what really hurts it is if you've got it on your counter or above your refrigerator or, you know, an area that it is going to get quite warm.
So here's a story for both of you to cry over. I once taught a wine class, and somebody asked me that same kind of question, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because it turns out that their parents had a bottle, a very special bottle of Dom Pérignon that they were hanging on to, but had been sitting in a curio cabinet in the direct sunlight.
So it was brown.
I didn't ask about it anymore. I just, my heart broke right then and there, and I'm like, yeah, you better tell them to drink it, but have a backup.
I think we should start normalizing conversations about aging wine and like not in a, you know, forever kind of way, but, you know, letting people know once they become more wine curious that holding a bottle, like maybe 5 to 10 years is a big ask for someone who is developing a curiosity for wine that has a little bit of money to drop $85 on this, but you know, 2 to 3 years will make a difference on that.
So Corey, we had Andre's choice, which was the Chardonnay. We had my choice, which was the Quatrain, and now it's time. And then I said, you know what? Let's do a dealer's choice, which obviously is yours, winemaker's choice, and you decided to go with the following wine. Would you like to introduce that one while we pour it into glass?
You bet I can. So this is our 2019 Oculus. So this is the flagship of the winery. It's one of our legacy series, and it is the Merlot dominant of our legacy series. So the reason I chose this wine is because to me, it's such a vision of the way that I see this wine going. When I make Oculus, what I want to see is understated power. So I want to see elegance, I want to see grace, and I want to see so much going on in this wine, but not so that it's hitting you over the head, but so that you keep coming back to the wine. So you keep smelling it and wonder what's coming out. You know, how is that taste changing as it opens up, as you said earlier, on the counter or in your glass over the next 4 hours or the next 5 hours? If you have that little dreg for the next day, how has that changed? So this one came from a vintage that was quite nice. Like it had this warm spring and it had a beautiful summer with nice warm conditions. Beginning of September was not great. It was pretty rainy and wet, but for the Bordeaux, didn't hurt it too much or at all, actually. And then we finished up the season quite nicely. Touch cool, but you have this, I think, beautiful acidity and beautiful fruit that comes through, and it's under, you know, woven through with some oak that sits there, but as a background. So this one is 52% Merlot, 30% Cab Franc, 17% Cab Sauve, and then just 1% Petit Verdot. And I love looking at the Oculus blends, because when you look at past through time, our very first Oculus was in 1997. So when you look back through time, it's in the very best years, so you have just a touch of Petit Verdot, and it's incredible how much of a difference just 1% can make.
So once again, this so you double decanted this when I tasted it.
Yes,
I'm getting even more flavor out of the wine now than I did then, and it was, and again, when you said, you know, I think we'll do Oculus, I secretly went yes.
I'm not gonna lie, I was also like, thank you when you suggested Oculus, because I've only had a chance to taste this one a couple of times. To me, this so I studied music in university, and when I taste a really good wine, sometimes it takes my head in a certain place. And to me, this wine reminds me of Carmen from the Bizet opera, where it's got like a little bit of an edge, but just this elegance to the arias. Like, it's, the tannin is short, but it's also happens to be broad at the same time. It drinks very easy, but at the same time, it's got an edge to it, having just opened this. If you're impatient, I don't think you'll be disappointed if you buy this wine. But if you decide to hold this for, I can say 10 to 15 years, and this hits those notes exactly
easily.
Like I said. This is exactly like I said about, you know, this feels like it has whispers of Napa Valley to it. But at the same time, it's also like tipping its hat to Bordeaux and just being like, no, this is where the Okanagan sits. We're going to draw some influence from both places and just deliver what the Okanagan's supposed to taste like. This is really tasty.
So this actually speaks to really the difference between Ontario and British Columbia.
Oh, totally.
And the problem I always have with the All-Canadian Wine Championships is that we are pitting Ontario, which, you know, for the most part, we make food-friendly wines because of our higher acidity, versus British Columbia, who has this kind of opulence to their wines. And just to have you describe the 2020 vintage, which sounds very similar to what we had here in Ontario, to what you had there, but the 19 vintage, you describe it much better than we would, which was a very wet, rainy harvest that never got to the point of at the end being nice. It just continues
to be
cool.
This is from a tough year?
This is from a...
19 wasn't too bad. Fall didn't cooperate quite as much as I would have liked, but...
Okay. Let's take...
Beautiful growing season.
Okay, let's take... Okay, beautiful growing season, but like, was it one where the rain started and didn't stop? Like, when did you harvest?
In September.
Okay.
There was a good kind of 2 to 3 weeks of rain at the beginning of September that were cool, but... You know, our Bordeaux varieties come in a little bit later, and by that point, it had dried up.
So I'd like to point out that here in Ontario in 2019, so in a typical year, we get 540 millimeters of rain.
No, you're mixing up 19 and 21.
No, 19 was that, wasn't it?
No, you're mixing 19 and 20. 19 was bad.
Oh, 19 was it was very rainy. 21 was even worse. But I thought 19 was the one where we had rain. We had 240 millimeters of rain in October.
Okay, so 19... As a writer and as a producer, I thought was going to be the worst vintage that we'd ever seen, but we had a cold summer to boot. So the Pinot Noir that we made in 20, that my little company made in 2019, barely hit 12% alcohol. Somehow we miraculously made a tasty wine, but it was just like, we called the wine rough because it was a rough vintage. Then 2021 came around and said,
oh, that's right. Yeah.
Hold my beer. We're going to rain nonstop from September until February.
Correct.
In the Hamilton studio here, I took water in my basement 3 times. It was the first year I'd owned the house. My wife and I were just like, is this what homeownership feels like? But we had to tell, like, it was thankfully not... it was an anomaly.
It was so bad in Ontario, 21, that we lost... Well, in 2022, we harvested 40 to 60% less. Because of that rain, it ended up pushing up a lot of vines and winter kill and a whole... There was just so much groundwater that
there we go. The winter kill was from an unusual region. Usually we deal with winter kill because of minus 18 Celsius. I don't think you guys get minus 18 too often in the Okanagan. Is that correct?
Oh, we have the last couple of years.
Oh, geez.
So we do, but it's not extended.
Okay.
So we'll dip down that cold, but typically it's not for long periods of time.
So do you... Okay, you know what? I'm going to completely bail on the line of questioning I was going on, and let's go back to the Quatrain and Syrah, because Syrah is notoriously finicky dealing with the cold. Do you deal with a lot of winter kill with Syrah, and is that something that might be a barrier to having more producers in the South Okanagan work with Syrah?
So we do, as I mentioned, get that cold at times, but we honestly find that throughout the varieties, if we're going to have winter damage, it's across a bunch of them. It will affect Merlot to the same extent. So again, it comes back to, you know, making sure you're in the right place to have those planted and in still slightly warmer locations. And then it comes down to timing. You know, typically here in the Okanagan, we won't be that cold until later in the season. So I'm talking like end of December, early January, where the hardiness is typically down in that minus 18, minus 19, minus 20 range already. We don't get as cold as early as what I think you do out east.
So I guess I have to throw out some kudos to you, because Andre just poured himself a second glass. And as much as I was assuming it was going to be the Chardonnay, it was the Oculus, so he's now double glassed the Oculus.
I enjoy Bordeaux. I generally enjoy right bank Bordeaux, but sorry, weren't you gonna know? I like the one in Saint-Emilion. I'm forgetting which is left and right. I've been drinking so much more Burgundy these days. Anyways, I like Saint-Emilion. I don't like the other ones, and this is more. Anyways, I sound like a complete fool right now. I do kind of know what I'm talking about. Corey, this wine is outstanding.
Corey, we talked about these three wines, and obviously, if I'm not mistaken, the Oculus sits somewhere in the close to but not over $200 range.
Yes, okay. In Western Canada, it is $185.
Okay, so let's, you know, we don't have them in front of us, obviously, and I have to be honest with you, I really did expect you to say, you know, I really like our you know, $20 Viognier or something like that. So I again thrilled that you went Oculus, and I'm like, yeah, but obviously not all your wines sit at this price point, $85, $185, the whole nine. Yeah, so. If somebody is going to want to get into Mission Hill, either out there in British Columbia, because I know we're listened to out in British Columbia, or here in Ontario, what wines would you say right now, you would say, go out, buy this Mission Hill wine at, you know, $20, $30. This is the one you should be putting on your table. It's outstanding, and it'll really give you an idea of what Mission Hill is all about in the lower price point.
Absolutely. So the wines that we tasted today were our absolute flagships. Across Canada, where you're going to see more of our wines are in our reserve series of wines. So within the price point that you were talking about. So I would consider grabbing, you know, our reserve Merlot, our reserve Meriton, still all those foundations of varieties, which I think we excel in the Okanagan Valley. So I would take those home and enjoy those in your evening, or our reserve Pierre. Or Reserve Chardonnay.
Did you say Pinot Gris?
She did say Pinot Gris, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Michael, look at you. I'm starting to wear off on you. You asked it like a full-blown marketing question there, and that's so unlike you.
Well, I really did expect, because I'll be honest, I really love the Quatrain and Perpetua, and I knew the price point of those wines. When I said, you know, winemaker's choice, I really did expect Corey to come back with, well, you know which one you want, our reserve Merlot, because this is the...
No, but okay, but this, but this is the difference.
Full on, like, total power.
No.
Screw this. I'm going with the Oculus.
Okay, but this is the difference. This is the difference, though. Corey, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Do you have children, Corey?
I do.
Do you have a favorite child?
Two of them.
Do you have a favorite child?
You're not listening
to the exact analogy that I use. You can't choose a favorite wine. You can't choose a favorite child.
But I think you did. I think you did by picking Oculus.
You did. I said dealer's choice. You could have said, you know what, I can't do it. You guys pick it. But you went Oculus.
Or you went with your golden child. You just went with your golden child.
No, you already chose Perpetua, so that meant that I could just do Oculus, and there we go. I've got both.
But you do have two favorite children then. That's what you're saying.
I do.
Corey, so, I really appreciate you joining us. I appreciate you for being a very good sport for us, putting you on the spot with the Pinot Gris question. And I guess as we wrap this up, is there anything you would like to say, because most of our listeners are in Ontario, that you would like to say to the Ontario market that might convince them to spend a little bit more money on Okanagan wine, because the wines that do make it to the LCBO are a little more expensive than they can get in BC, but are worth the price of admission so that they can learn about what's happening in BC. And we're so grateful that Mission Hill is in the market. And also, just a slight disclosure, while these wines were provided to us, we are not being paid by Mission Hill to talk about how great these wines are.
They just really liked them, and I wanted Andre to try them.
We're grateful that the wines were provided to us, but this is not a paid podcast. A reminder that Michael and I are still some of the few journalists in the province. So sorry, going back to the question, let's get some advice for Ontario listeners about what they should do to get into Okanagan wine.
Absolutely. So, you know, what I would say is try the Okanagan wines, compare them against some of the Ontarios, and just see the difference as to what two completely different regions can do. I love tasting the Ontario wines when I have the opportunity. Unfortunately, we don't get enough out here, but I would just say enjoy the freshness, enjoy the density of fruit that we get in the Okanagan, and the abundance of tannins that we can see here as well. And if you get the chance to come out to the winery, I'd encourage you to come out and enjoy them on site.
I also remember at the time that you were here, you were talking about the concert series. And I did finally get that email, and it looks like you guys are having quite the summer with good Canadian talent and some other talent too. I think Lyle Lovett is coming. Did I not see that?
He is coming. Yes, we have 5 different concerts coming up this summer, and tickets just were today.
So I'm expecting my my flight ticket and my ticket to Lyle Lovett anytime now.
You're pushing your luck,
know.
Michael.
I thought I heard this wasn't a paid podcast.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Damn you, Andre.
Oh, now I have to bleep that, too. Corey, thank you so much for the time.
You're so welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate you lining this up. I know we don't often say nice things to each other, but I was double booked the day this tasting took place. I really wanted to go. I was really curious about Perpetua, and frankly, I'm not going to lie, I'm still shocked that we've got a Burgundian-style Chardonnay from BC, and even you can't dispute that this is as good as I say it is.
Andre, I'm surprised that you can speak after the 3 bottles we just drank. Okay, I'm just kidding, but...
I'm Andre Prue from AndreWineReview.ca, which is not being updated very often, but just follow me on Andre Wine Review on all social medias.
You had never sounded more coherent in my life than what you just said, so I figured I must be drunk. I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. I have tried to do a little bit of consolidation, so you can actually find me mostly
at the grape guy.
Even the grapeguy.ca will now take you to my website.
So it was about a month ago now, but you published a newsletter talking about how difficult it is to be a wine writer in 2023 in Ontario. So hey, a special shout out to the LCBO. Thank you for supporting local journalists. Not.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.